Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll start out with Robert Kuttner talking about the economy. He's a co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, as well as a distinguished senior fellow at the New York-based think tank Demos. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe and a longtime columnist for Business Week. He is the author of two books, The Squandering of America, which explores the political roots of America's narrowing prosperity, and his latest book, just published, is Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. Perhaps jumping the gun a little, but we'll look into how a President Obama will deal with this economic mess that he'll be inheriting. We'll talk with Dave Freeman, who'll be joining us, a leading authority on production management and delivery of energy to large populations, one of the most experienced citizens in this country in terms of having delivered electricity to major areas such as Los Angeles and New York and the Tennessee Valley Authority is the head of that. He has a book, Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider shows how he'll be talking to us about the environmental propositions on the ballot, Proposition 7 and 10 in particular. He takes an opposite view on 7, which we'll be talking about. And then we'll talk with Joe Bagent, who's the author of the critically acclaimed book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class Wars. And we're talking about the class issues that have been foremost in this campaign, particularly on the Republican side, with John McCain and Sarah Palin running as populists using their icon, Joe the Plumber, who incidentally is not a plumber and or not a licensed plumber. And furthermore, when Sarah Palin says they want to tax Joe the Plumber, well, apparently Joe the Plumber doesn't pay his taxes. In fact, his house has got a lien on it from the IRS. So we'll look into the mythology of class warfare, how it's being used by the party of the plutocrats to paint themselves as the champion of the working poor. I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, as well as a distinguished senior fellow at the New York-based think tank Demos. He is a columnist for the Boston Globe and was a longtime columnist for Business Week. His writings have appeared in the New York Times Magazine and the Book Review, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The New Yorker, Dissent, Columbia Journalism Review, Harvard Business Review. He's also the author of a number of books. A recent book, The Squandering of America, and the book just published, Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. And of course, to some extent, you're jumping the gun there, Robert Kuttner, but I guess you've got the polls on your side in terms of predicting an Obama presidency.
Well, I actually finished writing the book at the end of the summer, and I decided to take a couple of big risks. One obviously was to assume that Obama would win, and I did that not just to be the first out with such a book, but because I thought that imagining what an Obama presidency would be like would allow us to really take the measure of the man, would allow us to think harder about what he'd actually need to do once he got elected, given the extreme nature of the crisis, which is also an opportunity in that 30 or 40 years of right-wing ideology have been hosed away. We now know, we knew it before, many of us, but now everyone knows that markets cannot be trusted to regulate themselves. And so we're going to need very substantial re-regulation as well as very substantial public spending and public investment, because if we don't do those two things, then a financial crash, once again, will turn into a depression. So the real question is whether Obama has the nerve, the political nerve. I think he will have the votes. I think he does have the intellect to do what needs to be done.
And as the economy has been crashing around our ears, it's clearly helped Obama. That seems to be the consensus of all the pundits. However, John McCain has finally found a theme. He's sort of been flaying about a bit, but now he's seized on this idea of tax and spend liberals, which is an old Republican idea, which has been recycled. And now, I presumably, his polling indicates that this is the best argument he's got. How do you think they're faring, the party of plutocrats, wrapping themselves in the mantle of Joe the Plumber, who, of course, is not a plumber. And Sarah Palin is saying, they want to tax Joe the plumber. Well, join the queue. The IRS has put a lien on his house because he doesn't pay taxes. And he turns out he's one of these right-wing cranks. And obviously he was a plant. Do you believe that in any way that message is resonating?
Problem is that this is, apart from the obvious inconsistencies that you point out, the problem is that this is at least the sixth or seventh theme that McCain has attempted to put forward. So his campaign has been all over the place. It has lacked a consistent narrative or consistent message. And what Obama has done to bulletproof himself against the tax and spend charge is that he maybe even has gone overboard to make clear that 95% of Americans will get tax cuts and 2% will get tax increases. Those 2% do not include Joe the plumber. One of the funniest things was the assumption that plumbers make more than $250,000 a year. And I think, although I hope when he becomes president that most of the increased taxation and deficit spending will go for public outlay, not for tax cuts, I understand why he had to do this. And I think he has pretty well bulletproofed himself against this line of attack. Tax and spend doesn't resonate when spend actually benefits people and when tax means taxing the wealthy. And I think the trouble the Democrats got into was that they were thinking too small. The programs they were putting forward to benefit ordinary people were token programs, and they were also failing to address the issue of who pays the taxes. Obama has done rather better on both fronts. Now, granted, history has handed him really an extraordinary, once-in-a-century kind of opportunity, and although Republican ideology has clearly failed, his historic task is to redefine progressive ideology and seize the moment. And I think the reason why he may well succeed is that if he doesn't think big, the economy will swamp him. And I'm betting that he's intelligent enough and committed enough to not want to fail, that he will think big.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, the author of two books that we're offering up here as a premium in our fund drive, which is closing out today. Hopefully, with this program, this will be the last program of the fund drive. And we're offering up Robert Kuttner's latest book, Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency, for a $100 donation to Background Briefing at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Then also offering up The Squandering of America for $100 and The Kuttner Pack, which is both books and a subscription to The Nation for $275.
Again, that has a nice ring to it. I should say the reason you want to buy both of these books, other than to support KPFK, is that The Squandering of America really tells the story of how deregulation and increasing income inequality over a 30-year period brought about this crisis. Obama's Challenge talks about what the next president is going to need to do to get us out of this mess.
And Robert Kuttner, how can realistically can either of these candidates deliver on their promises with a economy in free fall? It's pretty clear that revenues will be down next year, tax revenues, because there's so many people unemployed, and that unfortunately, that trickle-down effect, it will continue, as well as will the foreclosures on houses. There's an expectation that there'll be a cutback on social services because property tax and other revenues won't be coming in. So it's definitely a bleak picture there in terms of an economy that is, unraveling, frankly.
Well, I actually think it's an exceptional opportunity. I mean, the first thing they need to do is to recapitalize the American financial system and do it right, not the way Paulson is doing it. And that means a lot of direct government involvement in the banking system. I mean, when you have a Republican conservative Secretary of the Treasury proposing to partly nationalize the banks, it's a new era, and anything becomes possible. The second thing they need to do is re-regulate the system so that all of this government money, taxpayer money, doesn't get used just to have another round of speculation and bubble. The third thing they need to do is to put a floor under housing prices, and to do that by doing what Roosevelt did with his Homeowners Loan Corporation, have direct federal refinancing of distressed mortgages, have more help for first-time homeowners, for renters, so that these vacant properties can be reoccupied rather than drag down housing prices. But then after he does that, the single most important thing he needs to do is dramatically increase public spending. You mentioned the case of state and local governments with declining revenues. Well, Congress is talking about an initial package of $250 to $300 billion. Nancy Pelosi has said that she's going to bring Congress back in after the election to pass that package. And just imagine the Republican congressman who has hung on to his seat in a Democratic landslide, who's opposed to this kind of spending program ideologically, but his phone is ringing off the hook from mayors and governors, or governor and small businesses who were laying off people in the middle of a recession. So I can't believe it's going to be terribly difficult to pass that package. And then we need to go beyond that, not just have a one-time stimulus program, but $500, $600, $700, $800 billion. That's the order of magnitude every year of increased public spending so that we can rebuild infrastructure, rebuild American industry, have sustainable domestic energy, put money into human services so that we can keep good jobs, professional jobs at home. And, you know, 6 months ago, that would have seemed crazy, utopian. But now it is probably the only way that we can avoid having a crash turn into a depression. Now, you ask, how are we going to pay for this? Very simple. You can get about three-quarters of that by restoring the pre-Bush tax code, by inverting the IRS's enforcement priorities, which have given up on trying to go after scams that are perpetrated by the richest people, and instead they have put audit resources into going after people who take the earned income tax credit. You can get about $150 to $200 billion by winding down the war. And if you need more, you can pass a so-called Tobin tax, a small tax on short-term financial transactions, and then some of it needs to be deficit spending. I mean, this is exactly the time when it's okay to have bigger deficits. So I think...
Well, we've got them whether we like them or not, though, haven't we?
I think the if you do nothing, the deficit will go to about 6% of GDP, and maybe it ought to go to another 7 or 8% of GDP for a couple of years, so that we can finance some of this stuff to keep the economy from cratering. Now you say, oh my God, that's terrible. Really, really isn't. The debt, which is the total of all past deficits, is now about 40% of 1 year's GDP. Even after Bush's orgy of tax cuts and military spending, 40% of 1 year's GDP. After World War II, it was 125%. And yet, what happened after World War II? We had 25 years of economic boom, and it was a boom that was balanced, unlike the booms that have been speculative that have benefited only the top. And why could we have had 25 years of growth with that kind of deficit? Well, what did the deficit go for? It went to win the war, and a byproduct of that was rebuilding American industry, investing in science and technology. So if the deficit has to be 6 or 7% of GDP for a couple of years, that still will only increase it to maybe 55%, which is less than half of what it was after World War II. It's a classic Keynesian story. You know, one person loses his job, tightens his belt, cuts his purchasing power. The store sells fewer products, lays off people. The whole thing becomes self-deepening. And the only available counterweight right now is public spending.
Well, but it's a public spending that I take it will perhaps change the direction of what we've had in this country, which is a form of right-wing welfare where we've had unlimited resources claimed by the military-industrial complex, by agribusiness, and we've had these new forms of corporate welfare where they raided Medicare and given made HMOs. I mean, it's like taking money from the post office and giving it to UPS and FedEx.
Right.
None of it makes any sense. And of course, one of the most enlightened things that happened at the end of World War II was, in order to get the transition from a military economy with millions of men abroad, to reintegrate all of those soldiers and airmen and sailors into the an economy, they offered up the GI Bill. People got an education. An enormous amount of people got an education. We know we have a massive education deficit. So with some imagination, I can see that we could have a transformative economy here.
Well, hanging concentrates the mind, you know? And if he doesn't produce a recovery, it's going to be over by the midterm elections of 2010. So as I argue in the book Obama's Challenge, he's got a very simple choice. He can be a great president or he will be a failed president.
I see. And he'll be succeeded by Sarah Palin.
Well, he'll be stymied by a Republican take back of many seats in the Congress in the midterm, and then he won't be able to do anything. And then it'll be over, and then it'll be his fault. So,
Well, we know that a lot of stuff is going to be his fault because, for example, no matter what happens with Iraq and Afghanistan, both of which we've lost one and we're in the process of losing another war, it would seem that he will be branded. Palin's already talking about waving the white flag of surrender. So, if the Republicans are still obsessed about the fact that Jack Kennedy allegedly could have ordered an extra air attack on the Cuba in order to avert the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs, if that's become Republican folklore over the decades, you better believe that who lost Iraq and who lost Afghanistan will be a big theme in the next 2 years.
Although, I think it was yesterday that Maliki refused to sign off on this deal,
right?
With Bush.
And well, we may be given an exit then. You think the Iraqis will hand us an exit?
Well, yes, I do. But the point is, it's pretty clear that Bush lost Iraq with a very stupid policy, and he's still president for 2.5 more months.
Right. In terms of that, Robert Kuntner, when do you think, Obama's talking about a 90-day moratorium on foreclosures. Is there any way that could be done now? Where's Bush on this? Is he's just flaying about, as far as I can tell.
Well, a moratorium on foreclosures won't do it, because then the 90 days run out. You really need a comprehensive program of refinancing all of the distressed mortgages.
But why should the government pay top dollar for these things?
Government shouldn't. Government should pay maybe 40 or 50 cents on the dollar, which is 40 or 50 cents more than the bondholders are going to get if things go on as they do. So if you have one of these, mafia loans that somebody got snookered into taking because the fine print was so complicated. So let's say the person's paying 5%, 10% rather. The government takes that mortgage off the bank's hands, but only charges 5%, which the government can do because the government's own borrowing rate is only 4%. So it doesn't cost the government any money. It's just part of the national debt, and it gets paid back. And the individual gets a 50% cut in the servicing cost of the mortgage, and the private bondholder gets 50 cents on the dollar. So that way, these bonds are worth something. They start trading again, and that's what we need to do. In the Great Depression, we had a homeowners loan corporation where the government used its own borrowing rate, refinanced a million mortgages, ultimately. One homeowner in five got refinancing from Homeowners Loan Corporation, and that was sufficient to break the collapse in housing prices. That's what we need to do again this time.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuntner, who is the author of two books, The Squandering of America and Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. And it seems, though, just in closing here, Robert Kuntner, that perhaps other shoes will drop here in terms of a cascading effect. The subprime of its meltdown has been catastrophic, and apparently most people think that the failure of Lehman started that whole thing cascading. But the next shoe to drop would be the crisis in variable rate mortgages, of which there are, I think, about 40-50% of the mortgages out there. And then on top of that, of course, the compounding credit crunch on credit cards, because that's the only way people abridging their distress in terms of the household budget. So do you expect this situation to get worse?
Well, it has to get worse. Hedge funds are another one.
$62 trillion in credit default swaps out there, from what
yep.
I understand.
Yep.
And we don't know what they're tethered to, right?
Right. But again, that's all of this is more ammunition, excuse me, for the argument that if you don't want people to lose their jobs, if you don't want people to have to become more dependent on credit card borrowings that they may not be able to obtain, you need public spending. And if you look around you at the productive capacity of the economy, the ability of farms and factories and retailers to turn out products, nothing has changed. The only thing that's changed is the financial system. So we need to put a floor under the productive capacity of the economy and the consuming capacity of the economy so that life goes on as normal while we repair a very badly damaged financial system. And I think it was Winston Churchill who said that you can always count on the United States of America to do the right thing after they've exhausted all the other alternatives. And I hope we don't take a long time to exhaust all the other alternatives, because
nothing's going to happen until January the 21st, right?
No, I think some big things are going to happen. Congress is going to pass an emergency package to help state and local governments in unemployment compensation.
When will that happen?
That will happen the week of the 17th of November. And I think because Bush is in such a state of advanced collapse himself, and Paulson is so completely discredited, I think as soon as Obama names his economic team, they become the de facto leaders, working with an enhanced Democratic majority in Congress. And maybe, just maybe, out of concern for his legacy, Bush can end his wretched presidency on one grace note and cooperate with a new incoming administration.
And you have to add to that list of people collapsing in shame, Alan Greenspan, just testifying this week,
yes.
Pretty much looked pathetic for a man who's had such a stellar reputation.
Well, at least he's not in power anymore.
That's true. But just
grateful.
In closing, though, do you have any idea of how few people manage to destroy the lives of so many? If you think about these people on Wall Street who knew exactly what they're doing, like the hedge fund guy Paulson, who's made billions out of the distress of others, millions of people have been made homeless and have been impoverished around the world. And how many people do you think on Wall Street knew what they were doing? I'm not talking about the bottom feeders, the realtors, and the people who the rating agencies, all of that whole collusion that took place. I'm just trying to get a kind of sociological picture at the
sure.
end of how
I
few
mean,
destroyed the lives of so many.
Yes, it's Churchill in reverse, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
A very small number, I'd put it maybe in the tens of thousands. And it's even worse than what you said, because a lot of them didn't know what they were doing and conned each other into buying and passing along and blessing each other's products and then
right.
Passing them along to the general public. But I think for precisely the reasons you indicated, this is one of history's great teachable moments. And Obama is a pretty good teacher. So if he rises to the occasion, it will be many decades before the right-wing story of how the economy is supposed to work has any credibility. And that's the silver lining.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
And for your two books, The Squandering of America and Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. I'm now speaking with David S. Freeman, who's a leading authority on the production, management and delivery of energy to large populations. He has been at the highest levels of government with the ear of top federal officials since the days of JFK, helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority, the nation's largest nuclear program under Jimmy Carter. From New York to Los Angeles, David Freeman has headed agencies and utilities, the DWP, New York Power, continuing working to make utilities more environmentally safe, more efficient, and more cost-friendly to the customer. He's currently the president of the commission overseeing the Port of Los Angeles, and David Freeman's new book, Winning Our Energy Independence. David Freeman, you have also supporting Proposition 7, which has come in for a very expensive tax from about $30 million, I believe, the utilities have spent. They are joined by the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the California League of Conservation Voters, the Center for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Technology, and the California Solar Energy Industry. So how come all these environmental people are lining up against this proposition? And you, one of the most prominent environmentalists in the country, are in favor of it.
Well, I think that you can say that they all have tired blood and they're just nitpicking and they got their collective noses out of joint because somebody dared come through with an initiative that will move the ball forward without getting their permission. And it's a pretty sad commentary on the environmental leadership of the large organizations. There are a lot of small and grassroots environmental organizations that are still just doing wonderful work, and I see them down at the port. But this is an outrage. What you're seeing is another form of green power, the power of money. The utility industry, of course, is the one that provides the subsidies for the small solar companies, and they've cowed these people into going along with them. And as far as the mainline environmental organizations, they just are irritated because someone dared come through with an initiative that was going to go beyond what they're urging. And this initiative will take us to 50% renewable, and it will do it 2 percentage points at a time, and these utilities will have to belly up to the bar and get it done or pay fines. Now, the unholy coalition that's been formed is just an outrage. These environmental organizations are endowed with the public interest, and if they came through with a thoughtful statement that they don't like some of the details of this initiative and therefore people should be aware that it's not perfect, they would be serving a useful purpose. Instead, they lend their good name to ads that the utilities are paying for that are blasphemous, that are full of untruths. And they're attacking an opportunity to move us to 50% renewable by 2025, 2 percentage points at a time, bring the municipal utilities like LADWP, which is at 8%, under the law and require them to belly up to the bar. And then it provides a fast track so that the large solar and wind and geothermal projects that can be built will be loosened up from the grip of local folks that don't like the looks of a transmission line and are holding the things up, and provide a 6-month fast track at the Energy Commission, provided that they initially make a finding that there are no serious environmental problems. Listen, folks, Al Gore is telling us that we have to get this done in 10 years. The climatologists are telling us that the next 10 years will make or break life on this earth as we live it today. The ice melt is on the fast track, and here a citizen comes in and puts an initiative on that the legislature fails to pass year after year, and the environmental organizations are nitpicking at it, apparently irritated that someone would dare invade their turf and come up with something without checking with them. And I got into this because the environmental organizations asked me to join them in opposing it. I read it, and I found their arguments to be without substance. And even if their arguments are correct, the benefits of going moving forward so outweigh the questions about whether or not the one provision in there that says that if you can prove that your failure is beyond your control, you don't have to pay the fine. I consider that a fair item. I mean, this is, after all, still America. We don't string people up and hang them without a trial. Mm-hmm. They call that a loophole. So it's those kind of things that...
Well, give us a sense, David, of who is behind this. I understand it's the same people that were behind the medical marijuana initiative that was successful here in California.
That's right. It's the Sperling family who own the University of Phoenix, an institution that's educating 250,000 people a year. I went up and met the father. He's 87 years old. I looked him in the eye, and I said, you know, why are you doing this? Level with me. He says, well, I got a few short years to live. I got a bunch of money, and I think this is as good a way to invest it as any I can think of in clean energy, and I'm trying to do it. And I hired a law firm and wrote this initiative, and I want to try to get it passed. You know, this is an initiative that could never get through the legislature because of the power of the utility lobby combined with the municipalities that don't want to be regulated.
Well, that presumably explains why they're putting so much money up to defeat it. But still, the explanation for why these environmental groups, the NRDC in particular, is it you're satisfied that it's only ego? I mean, there's no other explanation?
Listen, I'm not good at reading people's minds and motives. All I know is that they're flat out wrong. And, you know, if you want to get right down to it, it doesn't matter who wrote this initiative and who the hell is against it. I mean, people can read for themselves. This initiative will require the utilities to move toward renewable energy faster than they're doing today, and it gives them a faster track to get the job done, and it requires that the fines not be passed on to the consumer. It requires 20-year contracts so the consumers will get the benefit of the later years when these plants will be paid for and have no fuel costs. If they're solar and wind, there's no fuel costs, so it'll be cheaper for the consumer. It is full of good things. It's not perfect. Mm-hmm. And you show me a piece of legislation that is perfect. And the last time these environmental organizations got together with the Edison Company and PG&E in the PUC, they gave us deregulation. So their track record, quite frankly, if I might say so, is not all that great. And I think I have a pretty good record for having asserted the public interest. And, you know, I was taught by a boss 40 years ago that it doesn't take much guts to oppose your enemies. What's the real test of integrity is whether, when you see that your friends are wrong, to stand up to them. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I think that when people hear the arguments pro and con,
Proposition 7 again. Yeah.
They understand that this is an opportunity that we can't afford to pass up. I mean, for gosh sakes, we just got through passing a bill that nobody read for $700 billion to bail out Wall Street. Isn't the planet worth a shot?
Again, we're talking about Proposition 7 with David S. Freeman, who's a leading authority on generation and distribution of energy in the country. He's headed up the Tennessee Valley Authority, the New York Power Authority, the DWP here in Los Angeles. He was made the energy czar during the California energy crisis, largely generated by Enron and by speculators. And again, as you just mentioned, the people who are behind deregulation, not only are there the utility companies who are now behind trying to defeat Proposition 7, also many environmental organizations lent their name to that disastrous legislation. And of course, the other proposition is 10, which is relates to renewable energy. That one is pretty straightforward. Isn't that the attempt on the part of T. Boone Pickens and others to get the state of California to subsidize infrastructure so that they can sell natural gas?
I'm not into 10. I think the argument against it is that it's taxpayer money that shouldn't be spent that way. The argument for it is that we need to do everything we can to get off of imported oil and use our domestic resources. So I think there are two sides, and people can decide for themselves. There are also two sides to Proposition 7. And what bothers me, and where I think the environmental organizations have crossed the line, is when they have not only decided to oppose it, but they are lending their good name to a bunch of ads that the utility companies are running on television to the tune of $30 million, negative advertising that are full of untruths.
Well, give us
a
brief.
Environmental organizations are supposed to be suing the polluters to clean up the air, and they did a fair job of that. They've crossed the line and now getting into coalitions with utilities trying to influence public opinion, And quite frankly, they don't have the expertise in the knowledge of the electric power industry that I have.
Well, give us a brief sketch of why what these lies are that the Noon 7 people are putting out on the airwaves.
Well, for one thing, they say it's going to cost every consumer $300. Well, they just pull that out of the air. The renewable energy projects over the life of the project will reduce the price of electricity because you end up with plants that are paid off that have no fuel costs. So the sooner we get on renewables, the sooner our electric bills are going to be stabilized and go down. But the reason it's misleading is, so what? Isn't the earth worth $300 million a year to save it? The second big misleading thing is that this is going to put all the small solar companies out of business. And it's just not true. The small solar companies are in business because of subsidies that are a different program that this has nothing to do with. And this initiative doesn't leave out small solar. But what they don't tell you is that small solar constitutes 0.2% of our electric power supply. It's tiny. After all these years, and I started it in Sacramento in 1990 with our solar pioneers, I love those programs, but they don't amount to a hill of beans in terms of reducing carbon. And we've got to get big solar in those solar thermal plants in the desert in hundreds of megawatts, and that's what this initiative will do. And I'm afraid that some of these small solar companies just are afraid that if we start really building big solar plants, that they'll be neglected. Well, you know, this is not about them. It's not about me. It's not about these environmental organizations. It's about whether or not we take the action soon enough to avoid irreparable harm from global warming, wipe out all of the ice in the north, and flood our beaches, which is the road we're going down unless we take some action like this.
Again, I'm speaking with David S. Freeman, who is advocating a yes on Proposition 7, a proposition that coalition of environmentalists and utilities are opposing to the tune of $30 million. You've attempted to explain the motives of the environmental establishment, if you will, for opposing this. But as far as I can understand, the reason the utilities are opposing it, David Freeman, is that this will force them to take electricity from small suppliers.
They've been opposed to going to renewable. If the utility industry wanted us to have renewable power, we'd have it. Let me tell you something. I've been in this industry for 30 years. Their attitude kind of goes like this. Real utility guys do coal, natural gas, and big power plants. We don't fool around with solar and wind. That's kind of elitist stuff. I'm exaggerating, but that's kind of the mindset. There's been resistance to renewables from the utility industry for the last 20 years. If there weren't that resistance, we'd have it by now. We have passed one law that says they have to go to 20% by 2010. Where are they? They're at 10%. Has anybody been fined? No. Where's the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power? At 8%. You know, the carbon keeps increasing, and this is an opportunity to take some real, solid action and give that crowd some marching orders that can be enforced. And that's why they're resisting it.
Again, I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles, David Freeman.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with David Freeman, who's a leading authority on the generation and distribution of energy in this country. He's headed up the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, and the Department of Water and Power. He was the state energy czar that rescued the state from the predations of Enron in that phony crisis that brought about brought down the downfall of Gray Davis and the ascendancy of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he's in favor of Proposition 7, which is getting a tremendous amount of opposition and money being spent from utilities with the stamp of approval from many of the major environmental organizations in this state. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Joe Bagent, who is the author of the critically acclaimed book Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, which has been described by the American Prospect as informative, infuriating, terrifying, and scintillating. Joe Bagent writes an online column available at his website, joebagent.com, which has made him a cult hero among gonzo journalists, junkies, and progressives. junkies, gonzo journalism junkies, I should say, and progressive. He is featured on the BBC documentary, The Vision, Americans on America, in which he comments on America's long history of religious fundamentalism. Until recently, he worked as a senior editor for the Primedia History magazine group, and Bajan and his wife recently downsized their lives in America so that Joe could spend half his year in Belize, where he writes and sponsors a small development project with the Black Carib families in Hopkins Village. Mark Crispin Miller says of Deer Hunting with Jesus, this book sheds a devastating light on Bush and Company's notorious base, i.e. America's white working class, whose members have been ravaged by the very party that purports to take their side. Meanwhile, the left has largely turned them out or even laughed at their predicament of their degraded state and therefore ours. Joe Bagent writes like an avenging angel. And Joe, you're writing about the very landscape that is ground zero in this election as the last week of this election gets underway. It's so clear that it's the white working class voter that McCain is desperately trying to get every last one of them, and Obama is trying to also appeal to. What's your sense of what appears to be utter absurdity of Joe the plumber, the icon for the party of plutocrats?
Well, you know, I don't spend a lot of time looking at Sarah Palin or Joe the Plumber because it's all part of the theater state and the media. Most of my writing and just living, you know, when I'm in America, I'm here in Red State, Virginia. And, you know, so I consciously try not to pay too much attention to the spectacle. It comes and it goes and the pollsters look at it and it goes up and it goes down. Right now, there's not a person around, working class people in Virginia, that care about Sarah Palin at all. But so I look at it from an on the ground standpoint, mainly because it's easier.
Right, but your book, Joe Bajan, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from the America's Class War, really does identify this key voting constituency that both sides are going after. One side is doing it fraudulently, in as much as at the end of the day they really are the party that's taking care of the millionaires and the billionaires and hung everybody out to dry, which ought to be evident to everybody based upon what's been happening lately on Wall Street. And then the other side, you've got the people who are considered, you know, the champions of the working class, who have a rather checkered record in that regard, who are being branded as the elitists. So
well, they are elitist. I don't mean to sound like I said in the last time I was on there. You know, I'm so far left, I have to send up smoke signals to see the commies. So it's not a question of beating up the left.
Well, you called yourself a leftneck. I'd never heard that.
Yeah, we have hundreds of thousands of them in the South. But what I was going to say was that the Democratic Party is nowhere near being the party of the working class and has had little contact with them, and this is what the cost of it has been. As far as the left neck, well, you know, I've been in contact with the Obama campaign. They've called two or three times. We have hundreds of thousands of people in the South that are very progressive. I mean, whether they're old 60s leftovers like me or, you know, our kids have green hair and they're pierced too. You know? And they don't like the regime. But they don't have an active role in the politics because of the Democratic parties in the South are still good old boy organizations. And so these people have no voice, and also they tend not to be as worked up about it, being part of the political junkie class. They're so busy working at jobs. So I was telling the people in the Obama campaign, recruit these people, get them out there on the street, you know. They'll do it, you know, if you make the opportunity. And I'm happy. I had a bet with one of them. I said the day I see Obama people in Southwest Virginia, I'll believe they're trying to make grassroots. And by God, they're in Roanoke and 59 other places in Virginia. And like he said, well, how do you want your crow cooked? So I was very, very impressed, you know, that the effort, belated as it is, to really be out there at the grassroots level. In fact, I saw him
saw the Obama people in the toughest bar in town the other night, and I went, hooray.
Well, you know, one of the myths that your book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, dispatches from America's Class Wars, Joe Bajan, it really does point out what's sort of swept under the rug here, the extent to which we are a class society here in the United States, and that we are in many ways a delusionary class society in as much as we talk endlessly about the middle class, the bulwark of America, the custodians of the American dream, if you will, the American middle class. But in many ways, it's largely a myth, and that we have a vast working class who are underpaid and overworked in this country, who this book really identifies and addresses. And you're living the life. You're not just writing about it. You're down in this environment trying to live on, what, $5,000 a year?
That's a personal decision after... Oh, I told myself a few years ago I'm going to be a better man after 60 than I was before it. But also I was becoming more politically aware and haunted by the fact that 6% of the world's people use 36% of the resources, Americans. And morally, you know, I'm not a Christian, but I was raised on a Baptist church pew, and I just couldn't live with it anymore. And so I made a deal with my wife, and anything I make from the book and speaking engagements and so on, I live on the five, because that's approximately what the world lives on if you average them all together. And it's not as hard as people think. I spend about half the year here in Virginia and about half of it in Belize in Hopkins Village, where you can live on $500 a month. So it's not as difficult as one might think.
But you're also down there in Belize walking the walk, not just talking the talk, and trying to improve the lives of people in the third world.
Well, it was the easiest thing in the world once I got started. I put $10,000 in my pocket and got on a plane. I had been to Belize before, and I was so frustrated with all the Hurricane Katrina stuff and all that. You know, you couldn't do anything. You couldn't make anything happen you could see with your eyes. But you walk into a village where kids need medicine, they have no school books, and this isn't the fly-blown property of India. It's the Caribbean type. And I could reach out, and I could build a house, and I could do a sewer line, and I could put electricity in, and these things made people's lives better and provided housing and a little sawmill there and so on. And being an American male, where your work is never done and you never see yourself do something greater than your pitiful self, you know? And to see that, hey, this is done, someone's life is better. Believe me, it's not hard at all now. And the amazing thing is I refuse to have health care in the United States till everyone has health care. But I go to this third world country, I have free health care. Now, I pay for it because I don't believe in using their resources. But can you believe that? You walk into the third world, I'm safer under a bridge in Belize than I am in Manhattan, you know.
Well, it's... The book, again, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War by Joe Bajan. And the extraordinary relevance of this book is that it really explores and explains this landscape that both presidential candidates are fighting over. And it should normally belong to the Democrats, but they've abdicated their responsibility and for the plight of so many American people. We're talking about the majority in this country are working poor. And it's this explodes the myth of this being a middle-class country.
Especially the class issue. The middle class, as it's described in the media and as it's sold to the world, as it's seen on television, is maybe 15 or 20% of Americans. You know, they got a college fund, and Seinfeld lives in an apartment nobody could afford, and a UPS driver on TV is successful and all this. And the fact of the matter is that... Well, the UPS driver might be a working-class guy, but the fact of the matter is, as I keep saying over and over, it takes about 20% of Americans are in an elite class. They're a commissariat. They're the teachers. They're the lawyers. They're the doctors. They're the people that tell my people, as I said before, you have alcohol in your blood. Your kid is ADHD. And by the way, that mortgage didn't say what you thought. And, oh, yes, if you get behind in one payment of something else, your credit card rate goes up. These people administer the empire. Now, we don't think of it that way when we're a member of it. You know, we don't think not only of our good fortune, but the power we have and the fact that our 401ks depend on some dumb mook like I went to school with and all my friends here having no health insurance, you know, working long hours. It's gotten really bad lately. Carpenters are working. What if you got work, you work 12, 15 hours a day because the fuel cost to get to work went up. But anyway, the upshot of it is that these people tend to live in metro areas. And when they live in small communities like here, their high school principals and so on, they have, by virtue of education usually, they have powers of an elite. And they think they're middle class. They see only their own kind of people. They shop at their own stores. They listen to NPR. They live their lives. But they don't understand who's wiping grandma's butt at the nursing home and who's greasing their Prius and so on. So, yeah, you know, by definition, if working class is, it's about control over your work and control over your life, not the money, you know. And like I said before, if the man tells you when to go to work, when you take your break, when you get your lunch, what you will be paid, if you get benefits, when you will get your vacation, how to do your work and how much to do, and when to take a walk when he doesn't need you, baby, that's called working class. I don't care what kind of white smock you're wearing at the cancer center or whatever, you know. And by that definition, 70% of Americans fit there. You know, about 20% of them are in this administrative class that turns the cogs of the empire and then bitches what it does overseas. And another, you know, 5% or whatever, entrepreneurs, businessmen, you know, small businesses and so on.
But isn't there a difference, Joe Bajan, in as much as the Republicans who've basically spent the last 8 years as the party of investors and inheritors and have created this enormous division in the wealth and made so few people so rich. And I was talking earlier with the editor of the American Prospect, Robert Kuttner, about this obscenity that's just happened on Wall Street, where he put the figure that maybe tens of thousands, you know, of people knowingly took down the economy and impoverished and made homeless millions of people around the world. It's a massive, not just a transfer of wealth, but it is the enrichment of a few at the expense of the impoverishment.
It's the last act, you know, of last stage capitalism. You know, there wasn't anything left to steal, so they stole the future, you know.
Well, but the difference is, I think, is that on the Democratic side, and you were just mentioning Obama's people have been shown up in the toughest bar in your neighborhood down in rural Virginia, which is, of course, is a swing, important swing state. The divisions between the people that you talk about, the mythological middle class, it's much smaller than we believe it is, and the large working class, there really shouldn't be any difference. And I think that at the end of the day, you'd probably find most middle class people don't really have contempt in the way that the Republicans say they have as elitists. They just aren't aware of it. And I think that most people in this country are basically decent people. And given the information and the awareness of this inequity, I think they'd do something about it.
Well, I think so, too. You know, liberals, you know, good progressive people that believe in the common weal, you know, the common good, which is a rare thing in America because we all have to fight, you know, to preserve our own security. The Obama thing, for whatever, you know, he's inheriting a bankrupt country and a bought and sold Congress, no matter what party they're in. But to see the groundswell, it's like I tell people in other countries when I speak there, look, these elections are close because half the people are not like that. They want something better. They may delude themselves a little bit, but they're not mean people. And the thing that's happened with the Obama revolution, as it were. You know, I'm pretty cynical. I mean, he's not going to change everything, but at least he's not a trigger-happy killer, and everywhere I've been in the world, they love him to death. Well, good. That's a good start. But what he's bought out in people, here's a good example. I never thought we have these undecided voters in Virginia. Well, traditionally, it's all been bullcrap. You know, they're conservatives that are playing coy about their vote, and they vote conservative. We actually have some undecided voters now. They were that and plus the 320,000 or whatever he's well, they've signed up for new voters. They tend to be young people. But I'm actually talking to ordinary working people that are undecided for the first time in their life. It blows me away, because one of my old standard things is, you know, swing voters are not really swing, but undecided voters are not really real, not in the South and in the East and the Midwest. Out West, I noticed they really were real. Mm-hmm. But I'm seeing them for the first time in Virginia, you know.
Again, I'm speaking with Joe Bagent. His new book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, is an absolute fact in this country that 56% of Americans earn less than $500 a week. That's $25,000 a year at the top end. So over half the people in this country are living on less than $25,000 a year. There's no way that you could pretend that's a middle-class lifestyle.
Right. And 1% made as much as the bottom 50%.
And these people normally don't vote, or a lot of them don't participate. Those that do tend to be those that have already been beguiled into religion, in the sense that most fundamentalism in the red states, I think, is largely a front for right-wing politics. But people seem to be able to get some sort of comfort out of it.
Well, this breaks down kind of like this, and I've looked at it all my life. I was raised a fundamentalist. I've spoken in tongues the whole thing before I became a commie. But
before you became a commie, did you say?
Before I became a godless commie, right?
Oh, I see. Are you not? I thought.
But I'll tell you something. The religious aspect of it, you know, when I read about it, they make it out like it was so well organized by the Republicans. The fundamentalists simply had church lists, and the Republicans had sense enough to ask for them. You know?
I see.
The other part of it is that the political consciousness, to the degree that it exists, with most of lumpen working-class America, it's not about reason and ration and who's going to benefit me the most, and I'm going to vote for that person. It's a social consciousness. I took a Spanish film crew yesterday around. I've been taking people from all over the world just into the heart of this thing that's in the book, out into West Virginia and so on. And it's the business of what you hear. For instance, you have someone who's sort of activist or religious or whatever that's on the Internet, but then they pick up something and spread it. And we stood in a rural store, a large store, you know, with a friend of mine that I grew up with. And he said, well, people come in here and say Obama is a Muslim. And he believes Obama's a Muslim because 10 or 12 people have said that. These are like little memes or something that travel around. And that is the political awareness and consciousness. It's hearsay. It's things that sound right but aren't right. You know, so much of the economy is counterintuitive, you know what I mean? And, the foreigners are always blown away. There's no real facts, no critical thinking going on here. It's an environment, and it's an environment that where the intellect is brutalized by labor, no time, no opportunity, but for generations. And so it's this thick kind of soup of darkness that the average urban liberal, and believe me, I mean, I've lived in metro areas and college towns ever since I left this place, because that's where publishing is. And you have to step into it, and you go, oh, my God, it's really going to be hard to clean up this piece of roadkill. Whoever, you know, if good people are elected, we're going to have a lot of work for a generation to get, you know, to do what lack of education has done to these people. And I say these people, they're my people. I mean, my father went to the 8th grade, my mother went to the 10th, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joe, we're so grateful for you joining us here, and I would love to talk on with you, and again, thanks for joining us, Joe Bagent.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry I rattled on here.
No.
It
you
gets
didn't.
Me going, you know.
No, it's.
Well, one thing, if the Democrats do get down here on the ground and stay on the ground.
Okay. Again, I thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Marcel, just speaking there with Joe Bagent, who is the author of the critically acclaimed book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Tina Yonas, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. A car skidded into the rain, making the last little one the same. One more light goes on in the rain.